From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Andrew Richards.
And welcome back to Defrag Tools. This is part two, a special episode of Defrag Tools, where we're talking about proc dump. And last week, we went over some of the opening parts and talked a little bit about when you would use it and things like that.
Yep.
Between the shows here, I was asking you, why don't you associate your files, your dump files, with the debugger, so you can just double-click on them, they open up. And you had a very good reason for this.
Yeah, well, I did want to jump ahead to the debugging episode, and you can do it. And what you have to do is, in the command line, you have to do WinDBG minus IA, right, which is install associations, right? And what that does, it will register, as you can see, dumps and mini dumps and handle dumps and kernel dumps and WEW is the workspace file for WinDBG.
Yeah.
So the reason I was reluctant to do it is when people do that, they tend to also do minus I, and you'll see that this installs it as the post-mortem debugger, which is also known as the just-in-time debugger.
Yeah.
So that also was back in the Dr. Watson days. Mm-hmm. It was also minus I as well. Same syntax, same lineage. The reason I was reluctant to do that is I didn't want people to go and modify their systems. Particularly, I don't want them to go modify production systems. Because what happens is, the file association one's fine, but the minus I one's a bit more damaging. And what it does is under local machine, software, Microsoft, Windows NT, current version, AE debug, it sets these two keys here. It sets minus P minus G minus minus P minus E minus G. P is the process ID. E is a handle to an event that the process can use to talk to Windows Error Reporting, which is who invokes this. And G is go, which is start the execution of the process again. The problem is minus G isn't the best thing.
Yeah.
This is a little bit old, and there's actually other things, and I wanted to keep away from that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing it does, it sets one order to one, say run it. It also is not 64-bit, 32-bit aware. You actually need to do it twice if you want it to be truly kicking in. You actually need to also do it here, because this only applies to 64-bit targets, and the one down here under WoW 64, which is the same layout, but designed for 32-bit programs. And so for 32-bit programs, this is what crashes, and then you get x86. Remember how I was talking about Presses Explorer having the wrong bitness?
Yeah.
You need to make sure that you use the same bitness debugger, or just-in-time debugger, as the target. ProcDump version 5.1 under development also has minus I, and it will do all of this stuff automatically for you.
Yeah.
I suggest for now you don't fool around with this, because you can cause yourself issues. This doesn't detach, which means the program never finishes, which means it never gets cleaned up, which means the service never gets restarted, and
yeah,
lots of bad things. So in general, don't do that. If you have done it, just go in here and press delete on those two.
Would you suggest you just go in and take the G off, or is that just
the whole thing is, well, the thing is, nothing stops WinDBG.
Yeah.
And so the Windows Error Reporting never leaves it, and you get into this bad state.
Yeah.
You just don't want to fool around with it. In corporations particularly, just let Windows Error Reporting do its job. It's designed to clean things up. As I said, when ProcDump version 5.1 comes out, which is probably 3 or 4 months away after testing and all that type of junk, it does have minus I, and it is safe, and it will enter these keys for you. But until then, just don't fool around with it.
Okay.
If you have Visual Studio, it actually has already set this. So you know how when a Visual Studio, now when you have Visual Studio in your box, it pops up on a crash.
Yeah.
Which just-in-time debugger you want? That's what it's done. It's just put those keys there.
Yeah.
So every time you do an update, you know, a service pack or something like that to Visual Studio, they will also get updated.
So should you go in and delete them then?
It's up to you.
Well?
On a production server, you wouldn't have Visual Studio installed.
Yeah.
So it's fine. You may debug sometimes. You sometimes debug on production servers because you can't take the file off the box because of privacy reasons.
Yeah.
Right, so sometimes you take it locally, hopefully use Reflection or something like that to make the dump fast, debug it locally, and then they kill it. And just, you know, high security environments.
So what do we want to talk about today? What are we going to cover in this show?
Last time we talked about, you know, size of dumps, but all we did was took a dump now. Well, how do we know that now is bad?
Right? Yeah.
How do we know it's not you know, it's 1 millisecond that way or 1 millisecond that way, right? And so it's all about triggering, and ProcTime has a lot of triggers. And I'm just going to use the help for my guide here. and I'll go from top to bottom. So there's a thing called exception triggering. So when there's an exception in a process, and I'm going to get to that in a huge amount of detail later, but there's exception triggering. Within that, there's whether you want to treat a breakpoint as an exception that's worth doing. Usually breakpoints are injected in code saying, if the debugger is attached at this bad point, do a breakpoint, pop up the just-in-time debugger, and then do something about it. Well, in a production server, the problem is ProcDump is a debugger. That's all it is. It's a debugging engine. It looks like you are at your desk, at your developer desk, but you're in production. And so by default, ProcDump says, you know what, if I see a breakpoint, I'm just going to let it slide and continue on.
Yeah.
All right. And so without the minus B switch, the minus B switch says, no, break in and take a dump file. And we'll get into exceptions in a huge amount of detail in a sec. All right, CPU trigger. So we're going to use Media Player as my example because I like Media Player. We'll get this guy cycling, and Golnaz over there is going to have conniptions about the bandwidth on the encoding, so I'll keep it nice and small for her. So this thing is taking up CPU power, right? Obviously, it's not free to render out video. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of my machine's offsetting a lot of this to the GPU, of course. But if we look at the process tree, Explorer itself's taking a little bit, and Media Player's taking 4%. So that's 4% or 5% of the box.
Yeah.
I have 8 cores. Now, this is an i7 with hyper-threading, so Windows very cleverly has actually turned off all the hyper-threading threads and just kept the real 4 ones running. A hyper-threading thread is worth about 25% of a real thread. It's not 100% CPU power.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a bit of CPU power here. And so what we can do is say, I'm just going to take mini dumps here just for the sake of it. You can take any size. When it gets to, say, 5% of the box and it's sustained that for, say, 3 seconds, so C for CPU, S for seconds, take a dump file of Media Player. All right. And so we can see here that, you know, it says it's 5% of the system.
Yeah.
So 5% of the system, so one core, I've got 8 cores, so 100 divided by 8 is 12.5. So 5 of 12 means that a single core has to be at nearly 50% or, you know, 40%. Well, it's not. It's only at, these cores are only, each individual thread is only really getting around 20%. Mm-hmm. So the granularity is not there. And so what I highly suggest people do is there's a switch called minus U, uniprocessor. So instead of scaling it between 0 and 100, and when you have these boxes, which I see with, you know, 128 cores, you're talking about between 0 and 0.9%. It just doesn't make sense, right? You scale it with uniprocessor. So if I have 8 cores, it goes between 0 and 800. Great thing about that is if you go into performance monitor, the CPU number, the CPU usage statistics is in that scale. And you usually use the performance monitor to gauge what you're doing.
Yeah.
Right? And there's a blog post I did on how to capture CPU spikes in Exchange, and it's called The Compound Case of the Outlook Hangs, and we'll put it in the show notes. So it goes through this concept in, you know, huge detail. But what we can do is now we can scale, say, 5% of one core, which is much smaller, right? Mm-hmm. And so this thing's playing away and, oops, just don't press enter on that. We'll do it for a bit longer, say, so we know that it's hovering around 8 to 16% of one core.
Yeah.
You can see that on the screen. So I'm going to put this at 10, and you'll see that 16%, 24%, and it's going to fire. Anyway, so what you can see is it going up and down. And so if you have a program that twiddles along at about this level and then goes up for a while and then comes down, and you go, why? That's just, we shouldn't have these big spikes. And usually it's one thread maxing out one CPU, but you might have 50 threads. And collectively, they might be at, you know, 187 out of the 800. But then you'll see this spike up to 320. So you'll set it at 300 for 10 seconds or 5 seconds or whoever the average distance is, and then you can suck out, all right, that particular time, get me a dump file.
Nice. Right?
And so it's a very good way of working out, hey, this thread is bad, and go from there. What we can do is open up that dump file, and this is really cool. So it procdump actually journals the cycles for every thread as it's running, mm-hmm. and whoever was the hottest is recorded. Right? So thread ID 3632 in decimal or E30 in hex.
Yeah.
Now notice how it says 30 down here at the bottom? Mm-hmm. Normally a dump file opens at zero. So actually what it's done to working for E30, you'll see here E30, the one with the dot is our currently focused one. Not only does it record the thread that was the hottest, but it actually makes the default thread that you see in the debugger that thread. So if I go K on this guy, look at the stack, this was the hottest thread in that sample period. Now, this is important though, it's a sample period. We sample for 1 second and then we go, okay, it's passed the criteria, take a dump. If it used a huge amount of CPU power and then stopped working just before the dump, it's missed, right?
Yeah.
So you do tend to take a whole lot of series. So instead of doing what we're doing now, which is just when we get one, we can add N, right? And so we can say, give me 5 in a row, so when this happens. And so every time, so we can see, and that resets the clock. So there's second one, there's second two. And so we can make it a bit bigger and we'll use a bit more CPU power. And we're way under. Anyway, so it will take a dump each time it happens. And then after the fifth one, it will detach and let it continue on. So that's CPU triggers. Great way of picking out that spike. But what happens if you want the reverse? What happens if you want to go down,
mm-hmm.
right? And the way you do that is we added support for performance counters. And I'm just going to show the help here because it takes a fair while to set it up. So at the bottom is a minus question mark, minus E. So minus question mark just gives you the same thing, and minus E gives you a whole lot of great examples. And the example for performance counters is here. You go minus P. So for example, give me a full dump of Outlook. They're using Outlook as this example.
Yeah.
At a performance counter. And then here's the name of the performance counter. So you can just go into performance monitor and just copy the name down.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says when handle count is greater than 10,000. And it will be greater than 10,000 for the number of seconds that you specify. So if you go minus S3, it has to be over that for 3 seconds.
Yeah.
And so if you have a program that goes down, usually there's another counter that goes up saying that your throughput latency is higher. So you know, average request is 1 second, and then average request gets to 3 seconds, 5 seconds, 8 seconds, because everything is jammed.
Yeah.
And so you can use a reverse, another counter that goes up for when the CPU goes down. So that's what you use those for. And you can use any counter. Now, the counter, as an example, is if the total processor time of the whole box happens, then take a thing of Outlook. That doesn't have to relate to the process at all. So you might say, when this process over here complains about its latency going up, it means that this process over here is jammed, so I will take it. So it doesn't have to be a one-to-one relationship.
Yeah.
And as I said, in the example here, you can actually use a complete box thing. All right, so kind of cool. The other thing that you can do, and one of the things that I think it was Alec or Visual Studio team asked for, was hung windows. So I'm going to try to do this. I had varying success last night when I did this. I am going to wait for WordPad. So W is for wait. So if the process hasn't launched yet, you can go minus W and wait for it.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to launch it from the very start, the syntax is minus X for execute, and then the dump file. All the things I'm typing here, they're all in the examples, so you don't really have to worry about it too much. We're going to wait for WebPad, because I know that WebPad's not on the path, so it's not gonna, I can't just launch it. Then I'm going to run WebPad. So it picked up, it does a 500 millisecond poll of the processes being made, so you will miss up to the first 500 milliseconds, so if something is going to crash instantaneously, you need to execute it rather than wait.
So talk a little bit about crashes. Can you use procdump for crashes?
Yeah, so that minus I, the AE debug thing is perfect for it. And the command that you would use is procdump minus, you would type in procdump percentage LD
mm-hmm.
space minus MA.
Yeah.
That's it. And then C colon backslash dumps. So it would be, you'd have to give it the full path to where procdump is. Oh, actually, it's not under there, it's under my. There's no path, don't rely on the path variables. And so you would do So the percentage LD will pick up the process ID that gets injected into you, then get a full dump or a mini plus. Actually, I use mini plus myself a lot because I know that I can substitute the pages in. And as I said, if it's a .NET process, it will automatically escalate to a full dump anyway.
Yeah.
And then I would say put it into dumps. And it will use the process name, and then it does ISO file format, year, month, day, hour, minute, second. If there's more than one dump in the same second, then you'll get -1, -2, -3, -4. So that's what you'd put in the debugger key. So let's see if we can... oh, that's what I was waiting for, WordPad. Let's see if I can get this down. So you know how you at the bottom, at top of the screen you can go... it says not responding, is that the word?
Yeah.
You know, the brackets?
Yep.
So it's the same API, so it's using that same subsystem in Windows. And what I did is I added a printer for my house on this. So hopefully, I think I have to go, oh, preferences. And I think, it's a bit timing oriented about when the timeouts kick in. But if the hung window detection kicks in, that's the trigger and you'll get a dump file.
So if that not responding was going to pop up, then that would be the same trigger.
As soon as Explorer sees it, it presses Explorer, would see it at the same. It polls for that every second, and so within a second of it happening, you would get it. So if you have a thread that's jammed, you know, because the UI's being unresponsive, then you've got your dump file. So they, as I said, the Visual Studio team, I think the Outlook team, use it for analysis of, you know, they just attach it to, in their test runs, and if it ever happens, they want to know why it became unresponsive.
Yeah.
So what else do we have left in the trigger list? So we've done CPU spikes, we've done hung windows. You can do it based on our performance counter. You can do it based on memory. So let's say that when memory goes above, so let's have a look at, where's my Process Explorer gone? So let's start a notepad. It's a huge notepad, isn't it? Start a notepad. And notepad is currently using 2.4 meg of commit. So this is in megabytes. So say when it gets to 10 meg, take a dump file of notepad.
Yeah.
And so it's waiting for 10 megabytes. It's only at 2 at the moment. And then I know if I do file open, it will spike. And so I hit 13 megabytes. It is polled every second. So even if I put minus S on here, it does not apply, right? So if I go minus N 10, give me 10 dump files, it's going to happen at second 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
Right? It does not wait for the second period, which means that if you have other things happening at the same time, for like example, CPU, as soon as the memory goes over, that's, I shouldn't do 10, 10, 10, like 5% CPU, for 8 seconds and 15 megabytes, as soon as it goes over, it's going to go bang, 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 bang. The seconds do not apply.
Yeah.
Same thing goes with performance counters. Performance counters do not, I think I contradicted myself before, but performance counters do not do it either. They sample every second. So you got memory in megabytes. You've got CPU spikes in system scale, 0 to 100 or uniprocessor scale. 0 to N cores, performance counters, all those things. The last one we've got is just straight a sequence of dumps, which we've kind of skipped. Let's take 10 dumps of Notepad, and we're going to do it every 3 seconds. Oops, every 3 seconds. You are going to get a dump at second 0. You're going to get a dump then when the dump is finished. Just say it takes 1 second to do the dump. This math might get a bit hard here, but we're going to do 3 seconds apart, 1 second to do a dump. You are going to be dumping from 0 to 1. We will then wait for 3 seconds. The next one will start a second 4. So what you're giving it is 3 seconds of runtime, right? It's called end to start timing. And then you'll take a dump file again. Let's say it's 1 second. So you're up to 5 seconds. Then the next one will happen at 8, 1 second. You're up to 9, 3 more seconds. You're up to 12 and continue on. Much more important with big programs. So there's ones where you want to go, I have this big server application, and I want to let it have 10 seconds of runtime between dumps, but the dumps could be between 30 seconds and 5 minutes. You don't know. And so it's really important that you get a specific amount of runtime between the dumps, but regardless of the duration of the dump file. And then obviously MA, MP, minus D and mini, all of those define different amounts of dumping and reflection as well. And so that window can be very variable.
So would you ever run more than one at once?
You can, actually. The engine supports any number of proc dumps at the same time. You can have any number of proc dumps against the same target at the same time, and you can have any number of proc dumps against multiple targets at the same time.
Yeah.
So the classic example is you might have one that says, I am waiting for memory to get to 10 gig, mm-hmm. right? If I have a notepad running. And I go, oh, I've not, you know, you're sitting there, you've been waiting for 48 hours, and it's like, yeah. Oh, it's not getting there. But there is those spikes. Okay, well, at the same time, we'll go, if CPU gets to 1% of the unit processes, I've got a chance in hell of getting something in Notepad. And the default, if you don't do S, it defaults to 10 seconds. So if I have more than 1% CPU power for 1 second in Notepad, it triggers. The other one's still running and still doing its criteria, so you can have as many as you want as once.
Nice.
The only limit you'll have is exceptions, which is the last one we're going to get to. Exceptions are a debugging thing. Only one debugger can attach to a process at any one time. So if you're trying to do exception ones, the minus E trigger, which you're about to do, only one at once.
Okay.
All right, one of the complaints and features or whatever I hear about a lot is, let's say I run a second notepad. If you have two notepads running at once and you choose it by name, it says there are multiple processes. Mm-hmm. We do not support forking out multiple proc dumps at the same time. It's under review, mainly because of this third feature I'm about to talk about. But yeah, if you're doing that scenario, what you have to do is go back to like Process Explorer or Task Manager and get the process ID, 4836 in this case.
Yeah.
And do it that way. It's a couple of lines of PowerShell. Mm-hmm. I think it's the get process command to, you know, find out the new rate of processes in the box and filter it down to Notepad. So you could easily, in like one line of in PowerShell,
yeah,
you know, script it if you had to. All right, exceptions. This is the big boy. There are two types of exceptions in this world. Good ones or bad ones? No. There are ones that are based on a language, and there are ones based on the OS. The language ones are actually just one error code in the OS table, right? So the you can have any number as an exception code. Visual C has an exception code called MSC in hex, in lowercase, which is 6170-something-something. Just one specific number. And so when you have your code, whether it be, I want Notepad. I think Notepad may be the most used example program on the planet. What do you reckon?
It could be.
Yeah. So you have try some code, and then you have catch. Right, I'm not going to worry about the syntax because it's different per language. And then finally, if you have that. That syntax is a language syntax, right? If it's a C program, you will throw the error exception code, the OS exception code MSC in lowercase. If it is .NET, you will throw the exception code CLR in uppercase, right? Two specific exception codes. Mm-hmm. Access violation, which people see, you know, where you read some memory and it blows up, that's just error code C000005. Breakpoints are C00003, single steps 0004. They're just codes. Proc dump is an OS level debugger. You actually can run your code as an OS level debugger if you're in the C language. And what you do is you put double underscore in front of these two guys. So instead of catching just that error code that's to do with the language, whether it be C language or .NET based one, this will catch any error code. So you can say, I want to catch access violations.
Yeah.
Right? Or you can actually say, I want to catch a... and what the OS or the Visual C runtime does is it catches the MSC ones and stuff like that. This is what you'll see. Procdump is both a managed and a native debugger at the same time. And so it actually is running in a way that it knows that, hey, these managed exceptions are happening, and these native exceptions are happening from a C language point of view, mm-hmm. and it also has an, around that an OS level exception handler, right? And so what we're going to do, we're going to use media player as the example here, because I know it does some throwing of things. So what we're going to do is, I'm just close some of these windows off so I don't go away. There's a little bit too many around. We're going to wait, we're going to watch for, actually before I do media player, I'm going to do it, the crash case because it's more easier. Right, so what is a crash? An exception is an exception. Anybody can catch it. Anybody can catch access deny, access violation, or access deny, access violation and go, you know what, I don't care that I read from memory, that's irrelevant, mm-hmm. right? I'm just going to keep on steaming along. Internet Explorer, all the Office tools, they all have what's called an unhandled exception filter. And so you know how it pops up and says, I am recovering your document, or do you want to see the last tabs in Explorer, last session?
Yeah.
That's actually what's happened. It's this normal exceptions, the language ones, have not picked up anything, and this outer layer is has been inserted by the program and has caught these big ones, and then they've written all this recovering code, right? Around that, there's actually one more layer that every program gets, and it's done by the loader, and that's what Windows Error Reporting is. You don't compile Windows Error Reporting into your program. You actually get it as a injection from the OS. The loader actually puts this last ring of defense around everything. And what that code does, it goes, that was bad. I'm going to go read the AE debug registry key. I'm going to futz with the memory, which I'm not going to go and explain what it does. I'm then going to invoke the debugger, wait for him to decide what he's doing. And then when he comes back, I will then invoke the Windows Error Reporting subsystem, you know, the dialog that pops up. And then when that's finished, it will then tear down the process, right? So you know how I said it was bad that if we go out to the AE debugger and never come back?
Yeah.
You just sit there and wait forever because it's going, well, you're debugging it. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to kill you because you're debugging it. You know what you're doing. Yeah. So that's what you want to do. So if we do a minus E, so exceptions, and no other command, and what we're going to do is, I know I've got a whole lot of programs here that crash. We can catch that if I was in the right directory. So this is a 64-bit program that does an access violation.
Mm-hmm.
Simple as that. And what you're going to see is, and here's Windows Error Reporting. So we've launched the program, we've attached as a debugger, we have noticed there was a first chance exception. A first chance is the throw, a second chance is like, huh, nobody caught it, and then minus E picks up a dump, and so you'll get an unhandled. So this is the last crash. So it actually has had two chances of being caught, on the first chance and on the second chance. And so it's written out the dump file, and then we detach, and then we let Windows Error Reporting kick in. If AE debug was set on the system, this would have happened, it would have caught it, and then you would have seen the AE debugger kick in. When it finished, you would have seen that disappear, and then you would have seen Windows Error Reporting. So there's a whole sequence of events. So a lot of the time, by the time it gets to the unhandled one, you've actually lost what you need. And so what you can do is, instead of catching the second chance, which is way too late, because you don't want where it got caught, you want to dump at where it got thrown.
Yeah.
Right? And so in this case, because it's an access violation, you'll actually catch it at the actual opcode of the access violation. So in the dump file, if you change to the correct thread, which will be the default context, it will actually have the very line of assembler that's wrong, and then a source code alignment with that. So let's do that, and we'll get a dump file. Because I have got node minus N on here, as soon as we hit our first trigger, exceptions a trigger, hung windows a trigger, as soon as we get to the N count, which is one's the default, we have our dump file, we exit out. So if we look at this dump file, so this is the crash, this is the second one. Straight to line code.
Yeah.
Right, which is awesome. You don't have to go futzing around. This is all being done with no symbols, right? You can do the same thing for managed programs as you can do for for native.
What about a modern application?
Yeah, so they're a bit complex, and we're kind of running long already, so we're going to have another episode. I think we're going to have, you know, Windows 8 and modern applications are a completely different beast.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is, I think we'll run another episode, and what I'm going to do is wait for a program called Windows. So what I've got in here is a .NET 2 program and a .NET 4 program. Right. .NET 2 programs by default run as a 64-bit process. .NET 4 programs compiled with Visual Studio 2010 default to 32-bit. And so .NET 4 programs, if you try to dump them with Rest Explorer and stuff, that would be wrong. So let's start the .NET 2 one. And you'll see here that we are watching this program. I've detected that CLR, and we've got this native debugger running, or the OS level debugger running, and we've actually also spun up a managed debugger, right? And so now, when I click on here, actually what I'll do is I'll add a new feature, F for filter. So you see how it just, the first exception that happened, it just got it because I wasn't filtering it out. So let's do that again, right? And what you can do is you can watch the flow of exceptions. So this is actually attaching to the target, interrogating the metabase subsystem of the CLR, and actually pulling out the class name.
And what was your F switch do?
The filter. Yeah, sorry, I should have made that clearer. So because nothing is matching the filter at the moment, it doesn't take a dump. But if I choose like tim.exp right there in the middle.
Yeah.
Right. Any part of this line, or you know, part of the number. Here's CLR in hexadecimal. So that's that particular one error code. Because it's that error code, I know that I can then go to CLR and pull out the class name.
Yeah.
Same thing goes with C++, so I can do the same thing. So now, when I'm looking for asterisk tem dot exception asterisk, I can now suck that out. And so if you have different error codes, and I know that I've got an example here, where what I'm going to do is filter for 171. You don't have to have the quotes around it if you don't want. And I'm going to wait for media player. So that was a .NET example. So you can choose like null reference exception, right? And only capture null reference exceptions, and every other exception will fly past. Runs at about 200 to 300 exceptions per second.
Mm-hmm.
What actually happens is when every exception is thrown by the .NET program, it actually starts a garbage collect. The garbage collect has two phases, a freezing subsystem, which freezes all the managed threads, and then actual garbage collection. When exception happens, we actually use the freezing subsystem that the garbage collector implements, and every thread is paused, the managed threads are paused, and then procdump involves itself as a debugger and does all its work. You actually can then get actually a native exception while the managed exception is happening, and procdump knows how to handle exceptions on exceptions and re-entrance and stuff. Right, so I know media player is going to have exceptions, right, if I use it. It just is an artifact of how it's coded. So if I start this wildlife guy again, you actually see every time this guy is loaded, I don't know why, it doesn't happen with music, it only happens with video, you get a C++ exception, right? And you get this weird class name on the end.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to remember is get rid of the AV question mark. This, between here and the at sign, that's the name of the class. So this thing happens to have a bad result. I'm asking to trace all exceptions, first chance. It always traces first and second chance.
Yeah.
If you don't have the one there, I don't bother going doing all the class name lookups. But as a debugger, I always receive both.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if I can turn that subsystem off.
Yeah.
So what you'll see is if it's a CLR one, it will just say .CLR on the end. Mm-hmm. And I just will not give you the class name. I won't spend the CPU effort. If we watch this guy, and then if I close this, oh, it's 178. So if I had, we'll do that again. So there's the first one, and then
you have 718 and 178.
It's early in the morning. That's what it is. And then you got a dump file.
Yeah.
So I have a favorite web page of mine, and it's called System Error Codes, and we'll put this in the show notes. on this page...
That's every, one of my favorite pages, too.
Well, as a person who has to do this daily, 718 in hex is in this range. 718. And then this is how you look up error code. So exceptions, yeah. Very regularly, a Windows error is actually, the error number is used as the exception code that gets thrown,
mm-hmm.
right? And so we can see that there's an RPC call that got canceled, i.e. the interaction between the video and media player, just like tear it down, we're done. So that exception is benign, right? The other way of doing the same thing, and I do this a lot, I debug Notepad, I start a Notepad, I attach to it with a debugger, and in this case I'm just actually just going to use a dump file. In here, you can type in any error code and it looks it up for you.
Nice.
So if I want to look up an error code and I have a debugger handy, I just start Notepad attached to it, which is F6. If I go start Notepad, F6, it'll be at the bottom of this, and enter, like, you know, it's a clicker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've done it a couple times.
Just did.
Yeah.
And then bang, because I've done it a couple times, all the symbols are preloaded, so it opens in seconds. And then bang, error, and then any error number. So I can choose, like, for example, that's the access violation. So there's the two-way, so there's the instruction at blah, reference memory at blah.
Yeah.
So this is the line of the code, and then this is the thing. So, yeah, exceptions are really powerful. You can filter them out. There is one limitation that I will mention is that if you have a .NET 4 program, .NET 4, unfortunately, the way that the CLR is written is once you attach, you can never detach if you want to be an interrupt debugger. So procdump is an interrupt debugger. What that means is I do a native debug loop and a managed debug loop at the same time. Because procdump, the way it's designed is to allow you to, you know, like take three and then detach. In a .NET 4 program, so .NET 4 engine program, which is 4 and 4.5, we notice that. So we start as a native debugger always, and then we add the managed debugging on top. Adding the managed fails, so we go, ah, this is .NET 4, isn't it? Yeah, it is. And then we drop the native debugger and continue on as a managed debugger only. So you will no longer get the native one, access violation and all those ones, right? If you want to persist as that, if you want to continue being a native debugger no matter what, minus G. So
yeah.
G says ignore the transition between native and managed. So .NET 2 engine, which runs 2, 3, 3.5, is interrupt and everything, you get both always at the same time. .NET 4 engine, which is 4 and 4.5, you have to choose between being a native and a managed debugger. Usually if you're debugging a CLR program, you want to be the native only. You don't really care about the OS ones.
Yeah.
Most of the OS ones are actually bubbled up into native ones anyway. Like if you do an access violation, it will turn into a null reference exception for you anyway, so it's kind of safe. All right, we'll leave it there. That's about half an hour. Next week, we will show you how you can use exception filtering, particularly against a modern application. Starting a modern application is completely different. You don't actually own the executable in the modern world, so you have to interact with a thing called process lifetime management. So we'll go through that and all of the tips and tricks associated with that and how you can pull out your issues in the Metro world.
Great. All right. So that's the show for this week. If you have questions, just leave them in the comments, or you can email us at defragtools@microsoft.com. See you next week.
Have a good week.